Welcome to the PR Moment podcast. Produced in association with the Marketeers Network.
Welcome to the PR Moment podcast. This week, I'm interviewing Amanda Coleman, who's ex-head of corporate communications at Greater Manchester Police. And she's also the author of the recently launched Crisis Communications Strategy book. Amanda has recently founded her own agency, Amanda Coleman Communications. Now, Amanda and I are going to be looking at the UK government's communications performance since the COVID-19 crisis kicked off. To emphasise, we're not attempting to assess the UK government's overall response to COVID-19, frankly, because neither Amanda nor I are scientists. Before we start, a quick plug from me. If you haven't already got your tickets for our PR Moment Lite series of events, you need to be quick. Depending on when you listen to this podcast, you'll either have missed all or some of them. So do check out the PR Moment podcast, PR Moment homepage for all the details. I should add, as ever, thanks so much to our PR Moment podcast sponsors, the PRCA. For those of you that are not aware, Amanda worked for Greater Manchester Police as its head of corporate communication for 18 years, and she was in that role during the Manchester terror attacks on the 22nd of May 2017. So she's a leading authority on modern crisis communications, which, needless to say, play out in a 24-hour news agenda and on numerous social media channels. Amanda, welcome to the show.
Ah, thanks, Ben. It's lovely to be here.
Now, as I said in my intro, Amanda, you and I are going to be looking at the UK government's communications performance since the COVID-19 crisis kicked off. Just to be clear, I'm not sure about your politics, but I'm not political. I'm not sure I like any of them, to be fair. So just to say, we're not trying to sort of take sides on this. It's supposed to be a fairly neutral review or overview of what's been going on just from the government's communication response. Amanda, one of the challenges of the government's communications campaign has been the speed at which the virus took place, really, isn't it? It took hold globally very quickly, and then once it came onto the UK shores, everything seemed to happen very fast as well. With that in mind, was it always likely that any response was going to be too slow?
Well, you're right. I mean, this, you know, I'm not going to get into any kind of politics, but I mean, I think the difficulty is, it's, you know, it's all the planning and preparation that you should do that I think most people will say, yeah, we should do it, but we don't always do it. So you would hope that when a crisis hit, you'd planned and prepared and you were able to put things in place pretty quickly. I have to say that the scale and the complexity of what they're dealing with at the minute, you know, I can see from, you know, because from my perspective, it's something, and I'm not going to use unprecedented because it's well overused word, but it is a massive scale. There's few crises that hit that affect everybody in a country or everybody in the world in some way. So the scale of it is just vast. And that clearly is going to be a problem. I mean, you say it kind of came quickly. It did, but then it didn't, because it had been lurking, hadn't it, on the news agenda from the start of the year, really. Only we seem to assume that either it was going to be like SARS and never sort of reach much further into the Europe. So perhaps, you know, it's the planning, preparation. Hindsight's always a fantastic thing, I know. But yeah, the speed of it, I think in terms of the speed of having to turn around people working from home and, you know, the lockdown, yeah, I think that happened pretty quickly from what went on. And that created massive pressures because you can't tell everybody what they need to be doing for their own personal circumstances in such a broad way. And that was part of the problem, I think, obviously, was how do you get the level of detail that you need to about what people need to do?
How good is the sort of connectivity of communications, if that's the right phrase, between the various different public sector communication stakeholders? And I won't attempt to list those, you know, those sort of groups much better than I do, but let's say central government communications to local government communications, and then to things like the police communicators.
Yeah, I mean, the network's there and the framework's there. From my experience, I think sometimes the problem is just the speed of things developing and the speed of how you can get information shared through those networks is usually not as you'd want it to be. So, you know, in a crisis, you want to be able to almost instantly update those people you need to, share things, get, you know, feedback and be able to develop that. It's not always set up for that. It's more set up for, you know, what we call loosely peacetime, where you haven't got a crisis happening, but you just need to share messaging. So, yeah, there's massive challenges, I think. And we just haven't got the structure that they have in some countries where, you know, things are kind of more centrally controlled to, you know, flow down, or, you know, I think that's part of the challenge. You've got 43 police forces who, whilst they're overseen by the College of Policing and the MPCC, do operate to police and crime commissioners, so operate slightly independently almost. You know, they've got their own issues that they're dealing with, and that creates, to say, some massive complexities when you look at it that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult spectrum, that, isn't it, between retaining control and therefore being very clear on your message and trying to get the help of other stakeholders, because that then brings complexities and different perspectives, and therefore very often the message gets a bit confused, doesn't it? I mean, we had the I suppose the early days of the crisis, there were various police forces that the messaging wasn't quite the same as perhaps it might have been.
Yeah, and that is part of obviously the speed of trying to, you know, go on lockdown and then make sure that people know what they need to do, make sure police officers know what they need to do. And you've got layers, haven't you? You know, so you've, you know, normally you would expect something coming from the National Police Chiefs Council, the MPCC, you would then expect that to be cascaded through police forces to get to the frontline officers. But at the same time, you know, officers have got to almost instantly react to what's coming out and the media and what the announcements are, because people are saying, well, they've said this is happening, so what are you doing about it? So, you know, the speed of trying to do that is really difficult. And we spent years giving police officers the ability to use social media and to, you know, go independently communicating with the communities, which has worked really well in lots of respects. But then when you've got something like this, it only takes one or two, you know, incidents that get noticed, that get shared, and you start to impact on, you know, people's confidence and trust in what's going, you know, what the police are doing and how they're dealing with it. So, yeah, it is massively challenging. And, you know, in the early stages, the message has been pretty clear, hasn't it? Stay home, protect the NHS, save lives. And there's been no deviation and everybody's understood that. And yeah, there've been, you know, complexities around how often you can go out and what does that mean? And is it an hour and all those sorts of questions. But I think the big challenge comes now, where we're going to end up with a whole kind of different strands or threads of messaging that are going to be needed for all kinds of different groups and communities and, you know, sectors of business, and weaving that kind of tapestry of into something that makes sense is just a massive challenge. I think, you know, nobody can or kind of underestimate the complexity that lies ahead at all.
Yeah, I mean, the messaging and the communication is about to get a whole lot more complicated, isn't it? And I, as you suggest, it's with various, presumably different people are going to have different rules, and different areas might have different rules, and some of it's going to be voluntary and some of it's going to be enforced. So yeah, it's going to become much, much more difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, and for me, that's where you've got to relinquish some of that central control that we were just talking about. You know, you can't hold on tightly to control at that point, because you're going to need those public services on a local level to be able to take up the nuances, you know, the differences, you know, and come up with what works for the communities. I mean, that's why I say for years we've been trying to make police officers who are working in specific communities be the main voice of it, because they understand what people's concerns are, they understand what's going on, they know, you know, what they need to focus on. And that's the same, isn't it, for councillors and, you know, you would go right across that sort of public service. It's a good thing that we've got in having 43 police forces and you know, all the council authorities that we've got, that they really understand the places that they're serving. So, you know, that's when you have got to be able to delegate. You've got to be able to give the framework and have the confidence that they can work through the messaging that's required. I hope that's what's going to happen, because, as I say, they're ideally placed. All, you know, the public services that we've been clapping for on a Thursday, they're the ones really that can make this next stage so much more manageable. I'm going to say not manageable, you know, but it's more manageable. It's never going to be nice for anybody, but, you know, we're all going to face certain challenges and restrictions in some ways, but they can help people work through that.
Right. Now, that, just moving on to the daily briefing. I remember the first one sort of came out. We were all quite excited, weren't we? It was kind of required viewing for a while anyway. But it's lost its momentum, hasn't it? Was that just always going to happen?
Yeah, it's really hard, isn't it? I mean, it's absolutely the right thing to do. You know, you want that regular update. And I think at the start, you know, it hit the right tone. It has the science and the health and somebody from government. And I think the problem, from my perspective, I suppose, is it's just come quite formulaic. So it starts, we go through the statistics, then there'll be, you know, an update on government, then there'll be an update. So it's quite like almost, it feels like a little bit of a tick box, right? We've done that, we've done that, we've done that. I think they've probably tried to inject something different in it by having the public been able to ask questions, but then that, you know, I'm not sure how that works really, but I can see that they're obviously trying to add something that makes that connection between central government and what's the big things that are happening and that local level, what people are really bothered about.
It's
really challenging.
So we all have our sort of favourite bit. I mean, my favourite bit is the charts, really. If I'm not, I could almost switch on for that 5 minutes and then forget the rest of it. But maybe that's just me.
I don't do statistics particularly well. So I have to say the charts just are a massive switch off for me. I'm much prefer to hear people's stories and something that, you know, kind of makes it real rather than just numbers. But I think that's the difficulty, isn't it? There's so much that people like or don't like that you're never going to be able to do one kind of quick half an hour, 40 minutes, whatever briefing that's going to be just going to appeal to everybody.
I don't think it's helped by the fact that there are they're not all lobby journalists, but there a lot of them are political journalists, aren't they, who are looking for the political angle on the story. And I don't particularly criticise them, because I think that you know, that's their job and that's what they're there to do. But maybe having a wider perspective around on the news front rather than quite such a political theme might help, because a lot of the questions are very similar, aren't they?
Yeah, and I think you're probably right with that, to be fair. You know, because this is a crisis that's about people, as most crises are. Well, in fact, all crises are people. You know, society is made up of people. The politics, yeah, you know, it's what a lot of people are bothered about. It's what a lot of people spend a lot of their lives, you know, bothered about. But this isn't about that for me. So perhaps that is why it loses some of its some of what I think it perhaps could achieve because of some of that. But yeah, it is what it is, I suppose, on the basis of who's involved with it.
Sure. Now, I'm just trying to work out, so as an overriding theme, do you think the government's done a good job during its communications during this crisis? Has it communicated well?
I think there's been some really positive elements, you know, that I have to say, that really strong message of staying home. You know, you can see that. There's lots of reports now saying people are really quite scared to go out. So, you know, they've almost been too good at getting the message across to stay home. So, you know, that's worked pretty well. You know, I think they've been able to try and mobilise a lot of the, they have, you know, mobilised a lot of the connectivity between public services. And some of that, you know, might have been slow, but did certainly have a big impact. But all, I mean, it, I think one of the biggest issues for me, I suppose, is getting the diversity in as well. You know, they've been able to reach diverse communities. And as we say, going forward, that's going to get even more complicated. I think some of that's been really challenging because, you know, there is no, as everybody dealing with communications knows, you can't just do one thing and then hope it's going to reach everybody. It's that constant thing. So, you know, there's been a lot of really good stuff, getting the adverts that you've seen on the television and that big message that's just appeared everywhere. But the next stage, I think, is going to be much more challenging.
I suppose that's an issue for governments across lots of issues, across lots of areas, but it's particularly important right now, bearing in mind the seriousness of the COVID-19 crisis, is that they just don't have the diversity within government to enable them to communicate as effectively as they would like with different areas of the public. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, it's been a challenge, hasn't it, for lots of groups, for lots of public services, for communications teams as well. So, you know, we've still got to keep plugging away to make that work. And it's perhaps where we need to step away from the broadcasting of messages to find a way of engaging with the public. Not necessarily in the public just having a question to ask at the daily briefing, but really, you know, maximising the connections back to the local services that the local services have, so that we can pick up where there are gaps and we know that everything, the people are being reached and that things are happening.
Sure. Now, I just thinking about those daily briefings, and it's always a bit of a when you know who you're going to get at the start of those briefings, it's always, you always, oh, okay, well, this could be an interesting one, you know, from a, if it's Rishi, you know, it's going to be about the finance. If it's Matt Hancock, you know, it's going to be about the health, etc. But which government ministers do you think have communicated well, shall we say, through this crisis, with a sort of a nod towards the briefing, but not just thinking exclusively about that?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Rishi Sunak really has. He's you know what you're getting, but he also, I think he's very clear in what he does. He appears very in control, very measured, but also has appears to have a level of understanding of the difficulties people are facing. So definitely, I think he's despite his, you know, he's very young, isn't he? You know, he's managed to do that and have that sort of gravitas to doing it. We've got really difficult messages as well around finances, because that's one of the biggest concerns, isn't it?
Definitely. But when he talks and he's challenged, he comes back with an answer that makes sense. You know what I mean? You might not necessarily agree with him, but you can see his justification for that answer, which isn't always the case, is it?
No, it's a bit like you can see the workings out on a paper when you used to do your maths, and you know, yeah, he does have that consistency, I think, that people want in a, particularly in a time like now where there's so much uncertainty. Actually, you want to know that when he comes out, it's going to be about finance, and he's going to, you know, be consistent in what he does. So he does. I mean, love him or hate him, Boris has certainly managed to bring a lot of humanity, perhaps, to some of the communication, because it's really difficult, I think, when you get caught up in the numbers and the charts and the figures for the death rates, to forget about the people that it affects, you know, and how devastating it's been for families, and the real kind of personal stories. And I know some of the media have tried to do that. Sky have been running some individual stories where they can, of some of the people, some tributes. But it's because of the scale of it, it's just really hard to be able to do that in any meaningful way. But it, obviously, because of his unfortunate kind of experience, it's actually given him, I think, perhaps an insight which has definitely come across. And you know, the interview he did with The Sun on Sunday was very, very open, very personal. And I think, you know, that is good to see from, you know, senior people in government.
Do you think if he hadn't have got COVID-19, he'd be doing as well in terms of his approval rating at the moment?
It's difficult to say, isn't it? But I mean, certainly, I think it's made him more rounded in discussing it, hasn't it? Because he really understands what it's like to go through the horrific position of being in intensive care and facing, you know, everything he faced. So I think that's definitely given him a much better position to be able to talk about what we need to do. And I think the, you know, people are going to be more willing to listen to what he says about coming out of lockdown and what that might look like, because he knows the kind of personal toll that it can and take on people.
And Matt Hancock, I mean, it's a more complicated one, that, isn't it? Because he sort of, you sort of, at times I find myself willing him on, but he doesn't quite nail it, does he?
Yeah, he's had some difficult moments. I mean, you know, he doesn't help himself when he's in Parliament and he says things about people's tone and it gets massively covered. He does have a tendency to, you know, just, yeah, like you say, not quite hit it or be saying things and it look okay, you know, and you're thinking, yeah, I get what you're saying. And then something just slips out that's, just slightly undoes the good work, perhaps is the best way of terming it.
He's one of those presenters who sort of looks like, oh sorry, sounds like he's just stepped out of a media training session, doesn't he? Some of the slightly cliched way he words things just doesn't feel that genuine quite often. And obviously the tone thing was just an extraordinary moment of theatre of all the things he might have said to a doctor who's just come out of working in A&E was just amazing.
Yeah, I know. It is. I mean, you know, it's hard in the crisis. You've got so many big things you're dealing with. I mean, they're dealing with some massive issues, aren't they? And you know, lockdown, financial challenges, etc. You know, all that. Actually, it gets, when you get down to it, the choice of words you use is still really, really important. Those small things are actually still really important.
Yeah, I mean, with Matt Hancock, the other thing with it is he probably had the toughest brief of a lot of them, possibly with the exception of Rishi. But maybe Rishi's got his bit to come when he actually tries to work out how to pay all this back. But yeah. I mean, clearly, but by the time we and again, keeping out the whys and the whether we did the right thing at the right time. But I think it's fairly well accepted that we should have gone into lockdown earlier. But because we didn't, PPE was always going to be a problem, wasn't it? It was just unlimited, unlimited demand and limited supply. So in a sense, it was going to be difficult for him to come out of it well. But in his defence, he has had it, and he does look knackered. Don't you? You don't get the feeling this is a guy who's not working hard.
No, and I think that's what you want, isn't it? From somebody in that sort of position, you obviously don't want them to look like they're about to keel over, but you do want them to look as though they're working hard, because you want to have that confidence that, you know, yeah, things might be difficult. Yeah, you know, like you say, you had a terrible position really to try and sort of deal with, but actually he's doing everything he can to do that. So you do need to have that slightly less polished look, perhaps, you know, so people feel confident in you.
And finally, other sort of major government speakers who bizarrely they're all men, aren't they? But Dominic Raab is really I don't know, I was going to say come to the fore. I'm not quite sure that's the right way of describing it. But he sort of took over from Boris while Boris was away and has kept being relatively high profile since. What do you think about that? I mean, I would suggest he got off to a bad start and improved a bit. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I think he coped. He seems to have coped really well with standing in. And you know, it's not easy to be to stand in with somebody like Boris Johnson, who's just such a big personality. You know, before he became Prime Minister, he's just such a big personality. To then have to step in those sorts of circumstances is not easy. It's not easy at all. And that's probably why, like you say, it was a little shaky to start. But definitely, you know, improved and now looks quite calm and comfortable in that position when he, you know, he's speaking to the media or when he's doing the briefing.
Sure, and just we haven't seen that much of them, but that might be, I suspect, because they didn't perform so well. But Michael Gove did a bit more in the early stages, but has done less and less, it seems to me. And Priti Patel, they probably fared less well.
Michael Gove, I just think he's like a Sunday man, because I only ever seem to see him when it's the news report, you know, the Andrew Marr and various things on a Sunday morning. So I'm not quite sure why that is, whether that's a deliberate thing or not. And obviously he had the problem in that he was in lockdown, wasn't he, for quite a while as well. So that obviously curtailed his ability to be able to do the briefings, which, again, you know, we forget that was a massive challenge, wasn't it? You've got a number of your key people who actually are in lockdown or not able to actually do those briefings and be there. Priti Patel, really difficult. She just never seems comfortable. And she really likes that. What we need, you know, what you need at a time like this is somebody who has got that human face, who does have that sort of, you know, that humanity, that, you know, empathy with what's going on. And she just always feels a bit aloof, and, you know, a bit disconnected. But I mean, Home Secretary is probably one of the worst jobs, I think, to have. It's always said to be one of the worst jobs to have in government, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, she can't, without sounding too judgmental, surely she can't be as bad as she comes across in the media, do you see what I mean? Because she's done well in terms of her career story. So you suspect that she might be better off camera than on it, but who knows? She's obviously an ex-PR person, so we can ask all her ex-colleagues at Weber Shandwick. I'm not sure Colin Byrne has necessarily been that complimentary of her on Twitter on occasions. But finally, Amanda, just tell me a bit about your book, which is called Crisis Communication Strategies, How to Prepare in Advance, which is something you've emphasised the importance of in this podcast, Respond Effectively and Recover in Full. But first of all, why did you decide to write it?
Yeah, it's been something that's sort of been in my head for a while, and it's been a kind of labour of love, I suppose, for the last 2 years. I've really wanted to write it because, for me, I mean, I've done 20 years in police communication, and dealing with a crisis has massively changed from when I started in 1999 to up until, you know, last few years. And I think for me, there was a lot of that thinking and that sort of experience of more recent issues that just wasn't covered in the books that kind of out there. I really wanted to try and capture what we'd learnt after the arena as well, because that was such a massive turning point, I think, in how a lot of what, you know, a lot of how we approach crisis communication. Because it was all the, you know, yeah, we've got the plan, we've got the policies, we've got the procedures, we've done the training, but all of that just doesn't hold together when you don't base it in the people issues, whether that's the employees and the people who are responding to the crisis or whether that's the people who are affected. So that's why I wanted to try and capture that. I suppose the other thing for me that I'm quite passionate about is I think we spend so much time considering the initial stages of a crisis and planning for that and being able to scale up quickly, but we spend much less time in what is the more complex area, which is the recovery phase. And I wanted to make sure that it captured right the way kind of through as well.
And so just working that through in my mind, so what you're saying is that and for listeners who aren't aware, but I'm sure most of you out there worked out when Amanda talked about the arena, she was talking about the Manchester bombings in 2017, that particular crisis. The you're saying that your experience through going through that was that the social media element to this, and therefore the vast number of stakeholders and the pace of which those stakeholders communicated, changed the, I don't know about the rule book on crisis communications, but changed how people needed to think about crisis communications. Is that sort of what you're saying?
I think the key thing was we'd a plan which said how to communicate when you're dealing with a terrorist incident.
Right.
And it had been built on experiences out of London and Paris and various other incidents that had happened. And, you know, I was pretty comfortable with what was in it. And I thought, you know, I know what we need to do. And we've discussed it with partner agency communicators. So we've kind of prepared as much as we could really for it, or we thought we had. But then when it actually happened, the biggest issue was, how do you support the families of those people who have tragically lost their lives? How do you support the people who are kind of around that, who have been affected in some way, and the community around Manchester as a whole, which had been massively affected by what happened? And that wasn't in any of the plans. You know, that didn't feature. And for me, that was the most important aspect of what we did, was to make sure that we could support those elements, and we could, you know, work to do everything we could really to help both the people who were affected and the community as a whole. So yeah, it was that really turned things around. And on the basis of that, we were rewriting plans, because you know none of that had been factored in. The well-being of employees, the support to, in, you know, your people who are responding, that hadn't really been factored into the communications approach that we were looking to take in any really meaningful way. So that was another massive part of it. So it was the people bit, that's why I say the people as a whole, that became the most important element of that crisis communication plan.
And what you talked about throughout this podcast is it when that happens, which is what the government are about to take on, well, not to, in a slightly nuanced one, in a nuanced way, but it's when those stakeholders and the messaging for those stakeholders becomes more diversified that it becomes so much more complicated.
Yeah, absolutely it is. And you know, you do need to be working with lots of other people, so, you know, in other sectors, in other business leads, in, you know, public services, to be able to get the best position for, you know, for going forward. You can't hold everything centrally.
And is that a point of empathy, or is that a point of resource? Why is that?
It's because, it's a resource thing, really, isn't it? You know, you've got to have people really understanding what's happening, understanding why you can't tell them certain things, understanding why you're doing certain things. You've got to be really as open as you possibly can be. And that requires other services around to be able to take the same approach, to be supporting you in doing that, and, you know, sharing the right messages and helping kind of get to where you need to be. So it's real, that is massively important.
Brilliant, Amanda, thank you so much for that. A reminder to anyone who fancies reading the book, it's called Crisis Communication Strategies: How to Prepare in Advance, Respond Effectively, and Recover in Fall. And I checked it out last night on Amazon. It's definitely there. Amanda, thanks so much for coming on the show. If any brand out there is wanting some help in their crisis communications at this uniquely difficult time, Amanda literally has written a book on it. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks for listening to the PR Moment podcast, produced in association with the Marketeers Network.
If you'd enjoyed the show, please do review us on iTunes and give us a decent rating.